Richard Carter has recently had a layoff from flying for a few years, but to anybody who's been flying more than 10, he's a household name. His achievements are legendary. He's broken more British straight-line distance records than anyone, 8 times in fact. This year, the magic number was 200 kilometres, with many top pilots hoping to break John Sylvester's 194-kilometre record, which he set in 2007. Richard did it on the 9th of August 2011 with a staggering flight of 253.4 kilometres from Bradwell in Derbyshire to Beaumont in Essex. In this podcast, Richard talks me through not just the big day, but other record-breaking flights he's done. He's a modest chap, and if you ever meet him on the hill, he'll be the one in the fluorescent 80s-style flying suit. And if you do meet him, feel free to buy him a beer. 253.4 kilometres, surely that's worth a pint. Just by way of introduction, can you tell me a little bit about yourself and when you started flying and why you started flying?
I started flying in my early 20s, I think it was. I was a climber, rock climber, and I spent quite a bit of time out in the Alps climbing as well, especially in the sort of Chamonix Valley. And when you've climbed for a few days there on the big mountains on the granite, your fingers are worn out and they're actually sort of red raw and bleeding, and you're sunburnt and you're dehydrated when you come off the mountain after 2 or 3 days, and so you've got to rest for several days back down in the valley at the campsite. I was just getting bored stiff, sort of sitting around for 4 or 5 days, couldn't do anything, and I spotted these blokes up on the Brevent on the other side of the Chamonix Valley to where we normally climb, and I thought, well, that looks good. Because you're sat in a seat, they've got gloves on, they've got a balaclava and helmet on, so they're not getting sunburnt. I'm going to do that on my days off. So I couldn't sort of afford to learn to fly while I was there in Chamonix or anything. But when I came back to England, there was some guys starting to teach paragliding in the Peak District. And I sort of signed up, had a couple of days with them, and sort of the rest was history, really.
Paragliding was obviously very different then, because younger pilots these days might not be as familiar with your name as people like me are, who've been flying for over 15 years. You know, you were the trailblazer as far as records were concerned.
I suppose, yeah, I got my first glider, and I was out on the hill all the time. That in those days, that there wasn't a great deal of experience sort of amongst the British paragliding community, and I made some horrendous mistakes and got blown over the back of hills because I just didn't understand that I couldn't make the paraglider go faster, and it was quite dangerous times, really, but well, we survived. And I remember going to, I think it was the first British paragliding nationals. It was down in Merthyr Tydfil, down there that way, and there were some guys from the Southern Club, the sort of Brighton area, particularly I remember Andy Knapp and Michelle Carney. And me and another friend up here, Dave Pryor, we went down to Merthyr that day. Well, we went for a long weekend, but I think there was only one good flyable day. And I watched Andy Knapp and Alison Sirrett and Michelle Carney and various others, and they circled up and sort of like disappeared over the horizon. And I'd never seen anybody do that before in a paraglider, sort of, not in England anyway. I'd seen people get high in the Alps, but not in England. And I really didn't understand. I hadn't got a clue what they'd done and how they did it. And I remember going around asking people, so like, well, how did they do that? What have they done? So, and so that made me really, really hungry to sort of find out, you know, how this meteorology sort of thing worked. And in later that weekend, I talked to those pilots that did get up and get away. And I think Andy Knapp set a new British record that weekend. It was 19, 20 kilometres, something like that, on a Falhawk Athlete.
I'm actually just looking at it. It was 20.5 kilometres in June 89 from Merthyr to Abergavenny. So 2 years later, you trebled that record, flying from Treacliff to Renbury with 64 kilometres, which was only the second ever flight over 50 kilometres. So you obviously had a very steep learning curve from your first thermal to trebling the record.
Yeah, I put down sort of a lot of my learning was I had this job in this factory that I was looking after these lime kilns, not that that's important, but on an 8-hour shift, I could read for 4 hours every day, really, while I was there. And I bought myself Tom Bradbury's Meteorology for Glider Pilots and C. Wallington. I can't remember the title of the book, but that was the author anyway. And I sort of read and read and read them until I understood them. So if I didn't quite get something, I could reread it. I got lots and lots of time, really, to read. After that, working in the factory there, I went straight from there out to Chamonix in the French Alps for the winter season, though, this was. And when the snow's rubbish, the flying wasn't bad. So little by little, I started to sort of put it all together. And I think I ended up, by the end of me, I actually did two winters in the Chamonix Valley there. I actually ended up, I think, doing about 20-odd kilometres sometime in March, flying down towards Ceylon, something like that. And it's then when I think I came back to England, and that's probably the first time that I broke the record. So, yeah, that's how I think I learnt an awful lot, really, because I just read and read and read Bradbury's book inside out.
So from that point onwards, you were just breaking your own record all the time. You're in the record books as just bettering and bettering and bettering the kilometres. And you were the first pilot ever to fly 100 kilometres in Britain.
Yeah.
Which must have been a phenomenal, well, you must have been absolutely over the moon with that.
I was quite chuffed, yeah, to get that. I remember the day, actually. Yeah, that is one flight that does sort of stick out. It was at British Paragliding Nationals, and funny enough, back at Merthyr Tydfil again.
Mm-hmm.
The task, I think, was open distance, and there was lots of, as you would expect in the British Nationals, lots of big names there. John Sylvester, John Pendry, Bruce Goldsmith, I think, was there, Robbie Whittle, Patrick Holmes, lots of people that sort of went on to be British champions as well sometime. And the sky wasn't especially good. It was probably 7/8 cloud cover, something like that. And a slight lead, sort of the top 10 pilots, whatever. We all got away much anyway in the same gaggle. With this, the way the sky was, it was just a drift and stay up and drift and stay up. And climbs were 250 foot a minute was a good one. And little by little, sort of, I can remember John Pendry, well, we probably all saw this little patch of sunshine appear out in front, and John Pendry decided to go for it, and he glided for it, and us sort of like pack stayed behind under this waffly little cloud, and slowly we watched John struggling to see if he would come back up, and if he would, we would all pounce on him and try and steal the thermal, but unfortunately it never worked, and eventually he went down. A similar thing, I think, happened to, I think it was John Sylvester, perhaps. I think he might have done a similar sort of thing. And we've got to, I'm guessing something in the high 80-something kilometres just by dribbling along. And to be honest, we're getting pretty bored. And I remember one time Robbie Whittle, we're in one weak little climb, and he shouts, "I'm bored stiff," or something like that with it, and decides to start doing the opposite direction 360s. And we're weaving in and out of each other, but it breaks the boredom. And we're having a laugh. I know it's against, I shouldn't be saying this, it's against all the rules, but when we did sort of make a bit of a transition, it was often, sometimes Robbie would actually lead the way, and we'd all fan out and go for a little glide and find a thermal, and we'd all sort of group back together and climb back up. And the last, but well, we're somewhere in the 80 odd kilometres, something like that, and we're not back at cloud base. We're only at, I think, something like 2,500, 3,000 foot at best, and cloud base was 4 and a bit, 4.2, something like that. But the climb drops off a bit, and Robbie goes on a glide, even though we've sort of got like half up, one up sort of thing, and everyone goes with him, and I go, that's too low. It just looks a bit too risky for me. So I stuck with it and slowly carried on working the 100 foot a minute job, and round I went, and kept my eye on that gaggle as they flew sort of forward, again sort of looking at a patch of sunshine. And they did start to find something, but they were so low that they couldn't get sort of centred and cored in it properly. Now, by now, you see, I'm at cloud base and I set off on the glide, and I just sort of look down and watch to see who seems to be doing the best and use them as more varios for me to find the best climb, and I sort it out and I get up and off I go again. And I think they land in the 90s and I just squeak over the 100. I think I get another small climb, but not particularly good. Land somewhere near Worcester, I think, in my memory.
Brilliant. And then you were also the first pilot to fly over 100 miles.
Yeah, that was a close one, wasn't it? That was a big jump, really, in the record, because it was it about 106 kilometres, something like that, at the time?
Well, that was your record, and then Matt Cook did 159. Yeah. But then, on the same day, you did 163.
Well, me and Matt flew the latter half of the flight together. We probably did about the first 60, 70k separately, and then we joined up and flew the rest of the flight very much together. And once we got over the 100k, I started being a bit of a vulture, if I'm honest, because I knew we'd broken the record again. And so I started just making sure whatever Matt did, I was slightly higher and always had that slight advantage, really. And we've got down near sort of Peterborough. The clouds spread out quite a lot. It's fairly grey. There's not a huge amount of sunshine about. But there are still sort of weak climbs. And my sort of thinking at this time is that we just need to drift and glide and stay with the drift, even though the climbs are dead weak. We've not got enough sunshine to guarantee us good climbs to be racing on now. But Matt goes off on a glide. I'm sort of like 500, 600, 800 feet maybe above him. So I just sort of mark him, if I'm honest, and set off behind him and above him. And he flies it, just glides in under the murk. He glides and hits the ground, and I push on a little bit, find a little bit of sunshine, make a tiny bit of altitude, but not a lot, but just dribble along for a bit and end up landing myself. It turns out, talking to Matt later on, that he went off on the glide because he was absolutely desperate for a wee. Wanted to get down, because I didn't know that.
Before we talk about the latest amazing record flight, tell me a little bit about how you kind of prepare for these flights. Do you actually deliberately go out to break the record, or do you just leave it up to chance? You just go out flying and see what happens?
It's a go out flying and see what happens. But on the other hand, there's a lot of preparation. Yeah, the day before this last record, I could see on the RASP forecast it was going to be a fairly decent day, but there was a chance that it was going to blow out. So I got all my gear ready, everything was charged up, new batteries and things in varios and GPS, that sort of thing, all my clothes sorted out, Camelback was full, all these sorts of things I think were done by about 1 o'clock the previous day. Bags, we've just sat ready and waiting to go. So there is a bit of preparation, I suppose, in that I know that all the gear is sorted, that I'm not going to end up on the hill with a last-minute sort of problem to sort out anything like that. And like most pilots nowadays, I've been watching the internet and all the forecasts to try and make a good decision about sort of where to go and when.
But your preparation doesn't extend to kind of looking at which sites it's still possible to break the record from, because obviously the big target this year was 200 kilometres. I mean, nobody expected you to, you know, better that by 53 extra. But, there's only so many sites you can actually do 200 kilometres from in Britain without hitting major airspace problems or running out of land. So had you kind of earmarked the sites that it would be possible from, or had you just gone out and, you know, did you just go out and fly and see what happens?
Yeah, I suppose I knew the potential from Bradwell. It's my local site. I've been flying here for 20-something-odd years, so yes. I knew that the potential from Bradwell with a north, sort of north-northwest wind. The other good possibility here is in a north-northeast, you can go out into sort of mid-Wales and well down to the South Wales coast if we ever get that far. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I've got a good idea in my head of possible routes.
And do you do kind of any sort of mental preparation or anything? I mean, other than just, you know, psyching yourself up for the good day? Do you have any kind of rituals or anything? You know, go to bed early or?
No, not go to bed. There is something I probably like to do, and that's at home I'll try and any of the jobs that really need doing, I'll try and get those done and cleared and out the way and sorted so that they won't be sort of like nagging on me brain, oh, I could perhaps do with getting home later tonight really because I still haven't written that letter or made that phone call, that sort of thing. So if you like, I can concentrate 100% on the flying and there's nothing getting in the way.
Yeah, you had quite a long lie-off in your flying. You had a break, didn't you? And you've just come back and just walked straight back into it, you know, without any sort of glitch.
Yeah, it was a semi-conscious decision. When Airways first started, that's effectively when I sort of gave up competitive flying because I couldn't be out on the hill flying every day and trying to run a shop. So it was a conscious decision that I couldn't be out on the hill all the time.
Do you think the layoff actually kind of helped you in terms of your flying so that, you know, you came back really enthusiastic, or has it taken you a while to get back into it, or was it just like getting on the bike again?
No, it has taken a bit of getting back into, for sure, yeah. I'm really quite enjoying flying cross-country again. I think before, when I was flying all the time, I was getting a bit sick of all the hitchhiking and the difficulty of getting back to takeoff, but now I've found sort of the few cross countries that I flew before this decent flight. With a circle of friends, you hitch to the nearest railway station, you get on a train, you end up back in Sheffield, and usually there's somebody there to meet you, and they run you back out to the hill, and it's just so easy and convenient now. So, yeah, I'm quite enjoying flying cross country again, without all the hassle of trying to hitch back.
Okay, so tell me about the big day then.
Where do we start? We start right at getting up in the morning, I suppose, which was pretty early, actually. It was about 6:15, I think, I was up that morning, because I'd been talking quite a bit with Helen Gant, and we were a bit undecided to whether the Peak District was the best place to be, or the lakes, because we were a bit worried that the peak would be just too strong a wind, and we wouldn't be able to take off and fly at all. So I had a breakfast at home, and I was at Helen's house for about 7:15, something like that, on the morning, drinking more tea, looking at the computer, phoning Wendy Windblows, sort of trying to make a decision, really, and we decided, actually, that the Peak District probably was the best place to be. Although the wind in the lakes may be slightly more favourable, the RASP forecast wasn't as good. So we came back, back into Derbyshire. Now this is a stroke of luck almost, really, because we didn't travel. I came back into Derbyshire quite early. So I went to the cafe and had myself a full cooked English breakfast. So now I had two breakfasts in the space of about 2 hours. So I'm really quite well fed, but I've made sure I've not drunk too much. You know, everyone knows about the problems of wheeze in the air. So I get onto Bradwell Edge, I think, about 9:30-ish, something like that. And Helen's actually made her own way to the hill, and she just takes off just as I'm starting to get ready, and she's in the air 10 minutes before me, something like that. So this is just before 10 o'clock, I think I take off. And we both sort of punt around a bit. The wind's fine. It's, I don't know, 10, 15 miles per hour on takeoff, something like that. So there's no problem getting off at all. And there's a few thermals breaking through here and there, and we're finding little bits and bobs. But until, I think it's about 10:15, we both, I think it was Helen actually, might have just found it slightly before me. But we weren't very far apart. We were only 100 yards apart, something like that. And we both climb away. Now, I can remember seeing on the RASP forecast that the thermal strength should be strong enough by about 10 o'clock. And the chances are it's going to blow out as soon as the thermals really get going. So I'm quite happy just to commit, really, on this first thermal, even though it's, like I said, just gone 10 o'clock in the morning. So we both, Helen's obviously of the same mind, we both circle away and commit over the back quite quickly. But looking at my track log, it only gets us this one to about 2,700 above sea level, something like that. The clouds look brilliant. I thought in that first climb we were going to go all the way to cloud base, but it never happened. And I'm guessing we were probably 1,500 short of cloud base, something like that. So anyway, the climb's petered out. I'm fairly sure it's just died. We haven't sort of lost it and fallen out the front, the back, or the sides. And so we glide off downwind. So me and Helen, we've topped out that first climb and we start heading off downwind towards Shatton Mast, which is the next sort of high ground, straight downwind. And we've both sort of seen a cloud that looks fairly decent and we head for it. And there's something there, there's little bubbles and things and we're sort of maintaining, but we're not climbing and really, sort of, well, we need to be going up rather than just dribbling because we're soon going to end up on the ground if we don't find a decent climb. And Helen finds little cores, I find little bits, but they fall apart, we're not doing very well. And I look at the ground and there's quite a bit of sunshine to the northeast. An upslope in a bowl, and I look at that and I think that's where it's coming from. That's where the warm air is coming from that's making this cloud above us. So I move, glide for about 20 seconds, something like that, to the northeast to position myself more over this patch of sunshine, but I'm a lot less under the cloud, if you see what I mean. And there it is, straight into it. I think it's doing about 400 foot a minute, something like that. And Helen's followed me. She's only 100 yards away, something like that. And we both climb up. This time I've got a slight height advantage. I think we top the climb out. Still don't actually get to cloud base, but we're a little bit closer, I think, this time. And I've got maybe 150 foot, something like that, on Helen. And it's time to glide again. Now, because that sunshine works so well for me, I like look downwind and Kerber and Baslow Edge is just bathed in sunshine. Even though there's no cumulus over it, it's bathed in sunshine. And I'm starting to suspect that these clouds sort of are quite short-lived. They're fairly thin. They're not very substantial. Now, Helen heads a little bit more south than my glide towards a cloud. And I just go straight for the sunshine. So we part by quite maybe 1.5-2 kilometers, something like that. And anyway, I stumble into it, and on the upslope going up towards Baslow Edge, I'm climbing again quite nicely, 400 foot a minute, something like that. And Helen finds nothing under a cloud, but comes back in underneath me, quite a bit lower by now. And she does find something, and she starts to core it and what have you, which is nice for me because I know this isn't a little isolated bubble now. I know it's a long column of warm rising air, because if she's in rising air down there, 1,500-2,000 foot below me, then this is obviously one huge, big, long column. And I think a cumulus does form above me. So I'm sort of quite happy now, really. I'm all right. And unfortunately, Helen falls out the bottom of it, I suppose, or out the side. I'm not quite sure. Which, you know, I'm watching as she's struggling along, but anyway, eventually ends up just on the moorland, just behind sort of Chatsworth Edge. So I've watched her go down, and, oh, bugger. That's me on my own now then. Just a case of, do whatever I feel right. I suppose it, in some ways this is now, I'm gonna look on the positive side, that any decisions I make, I've not got to like look to see what Helen's doing, because she's a damn good pilot. She's, you know, top British girl in Britain at the moment, so she might make the right decision sometimes, and I need, if I was flying with her, to take that into account, if you see what I mean. So now it's, anyway, it's just my decisions and I do whatever I feel right. And there's another patch of sunshine, a lot of grey cloud about, but this patch of sunshine on the moors over behind Chatsworth, and I just glide off there and lo and behold, it works. And there is already a cumulus sort of in the right position. I'm sure it's being fed, and anyway, I climbed quite nicely. But still don't get to cloud base. I think we're into the third or fourth climb now, something like that. And they keep dying off.
Was base lifting by this point?
It probably was. I'm sure it would have been, yes. So although I'm getting higher, cloud base is going up, yeah. There's a big reservoir not so far downwind. I think it's not the next climb, but the climb after that. The reservoir's called Ogston, I think, reservoir, and there's quite a lot more sunshine around now. We seem to have got out of this little patch of overdevelopment, and I climb quite well here. You might be doing six, averaging sort of 600 foot a minute at times, and I get to cloud base this time for the first time. So I've probably done, I don't know, 25k, probably something like that, before I get to cloud base the first time. I now realise I'm starting to get a bit towards Nottingham airspace. I'm actually under, I think it's the flight level 5.5 part, so it's not a problem at the moment, but if I carry on with this straight downwind track and I climb again the same height next time, I'm going to be under the 4.5 bit, or 4, anyway, Nottingham airspace, East Midlands is getting lower and it's becoming a problem, so I make a real deliberate move across east. I'm looking at the clouds, paying a little bit of attention to them, but the most important factor for me now is the ground. I seem to be picking everything off the ground, rising up slopes, sunshine, they're the triggers really. The clouds are often so short-lived that you can start gliding for one and it's disappeared before you've got there.
How strong was the wind by this point?
I don't know, because my Vario doesn't tell me, but it was reasonable, because when you look down at the ground at the cloud shadows, I could quite easily discern that they were moving across the fields. I wouldn't say it's picked up, but up at cloud base, the wind is reasonable, so I don't know if it's 20 miles an hour or something like that at cloud base. I'm making a guess, really. Like I say, I've not got a posh instrument, or I didn't have anyway, a posh instrument then to tell me, work out what the wind speed is.
But you were getting quite a good distance in each thermal.
Yeah. My memory, looking back at the flight, is often if I picked a climb off a village or something, or a town, when I look back at that town, I would have an angle of maybe 45 degrees, something like that, when I topped that climb out. So I was making good distance even when I was thermally. Where have I got to? Right, I've moved out and out from underneath East Midlands airspace. Now, this part of the country I'm quite familiar with, because I'm actually from Nottinghamshire as a young lad. And when I first started flying and when I was rock climbing, I used to drive from Nottinghamshire out into the Peak District. So I know where I am quite well. So navigation, even with the GPS, not that, because that tells you where you are anyway, but I know that Syston Airfield is coming up, and that's a controlled bit of airspace that we can't go into. It's a gliding club, actually, but anyway, we're still not allowed in there. So things like that aren't taking me by surprise. Just a bit further downwind as well, there's Langer Airfield. That's a parachute drop zone, again, which we can't go into. So I know exactly where I am in relation to these two obstacles that are coming up. And I decide to go to the west of Syston. So the next climb or two, I'm looking at climbs. As I'm looking downwind, I'm looking anything sort of in the right-hand quarter, really, to try and make space back to the right to stay away from Syston. And as soon as that's passed, I then start looking for climbs in the left-hand quarter, if you see what I mean, looking downwind. Again, still looking at ground sources most of the time, taking a little bit of notice of the clouds, but not a huge amount. Just after Syston, I remember there's a massive big area of cornfields, and to me, that was just the dominant factor there, that there was a town, but it was a little town of Bingham, but it wasn't that big, and I think it might have been in the shade as well, perhaps, at the time. So the cornfield, anyway, was the place for me to go, and off I went, and there it was. There was a big lack of birds. I can't remember ever sharing a thermal with swift swallows or anything, which surprised me, really. I thought they'd still be around this time of year. Right, yeah, I'm sort of between Bingham and Grantham. Again, it's still familiar terrain. I'm not very far away from my hometown. And I find a climb, I suppose a little bit of local knowledge may help here, perhaps, because I know that Beaver Castle sits on quite a ridge. And again, there's good cornfields, that sort of direction. So off I go, and I just start to find the bottom of a climb, and I fly with a radio like most sort of paraglider pilots do, and I've heard nothing all day on it whatsoever, but it bursts into life. And there's a little bit of a chat between a couple of pilots, and I reply to, I think somebody maybe asks if I'm there. And I say, yeah, it's Richard Carter here. I'm just between Beaver Castle and, or near Grantham, I think was my reply at the time. And then the question came back, sort of, are you still flying? And I've just found the bottom of this thermal, so I'm concentrating quite hard, really, to find the centre of the core and start climbing. So I don't answer for maybe 30 seconds, something like that, but then, yeah, answer back that, yes, I'm still flying, which I suppose I have a little chuckle, because I sort of sensed the question was they were hoping I was on the ground, but obviously I wasn't. Right, the next sort of, I don't know how many kilometres it is down to Peterborough, but it's relatively clear of airspace. You've got a couple of RAF bases on the right-hand side, but they're not a big problem. They're not actually quite on track. There is a parachute drop zone, though. I think it's near March, which is to the west of Peterborough. And as it turns out, that is right on track, and I've got to make some deliberate moves back to the west to make sure that I don't drift into that. I could have easily sort of blundered into that, and that would have been the end of the flight. But, I've got two instruments with airspace on them, a Garmin 76 that has sort of like a line diagram with airspace on it, and I've also got like a car sat-nav sort of thing with colour air maps on, just like the paper ones that you see that. So I've got two sort of references, and I've got a paper half mil air map as well. So I've got quite a bit of information that I find the paper air map very good for looking at the big picture. You know, you can sort of look 50k, 100 kilometres downwind and get a gist of your general line and your track. And the two sort of electronic instruments are brilliant for the fine detail. If you need to just scrape right past real close to something, you can zoom in and you can go within a few metres of the edge of the controlled airspace. I do remember quite a climb, I think it was just after Peterborough. I think it's a brickworks, and it's got two chimneys, maybe about 1.5 kilometres apart, something like that. And the smoke from the upwind one was pointing straight downwind and fairly horizontal. And the smoke from the one more downwind, sort of the most southerly chimney, had a lot more vertical component in it, a big difference. And I sort of figured that there's something drawing that upwind smoke towards the other smoke, and then the downwind smoke rising vertical, there was probably a reasonable thermal ground there. So I glided that way, and lo and behold, found it again. I'm pretty sure I got to cloud base with that one, actually. It's several times I'm still often not getting to cloud base. I'm probably getting 4,500, something like that. Maybe nearly 5,000, perhaps, by now. It's now, think about the time. As I passed Grantham, I think that was about midday. I think that was about 12 o'clockish, something like that. And I do remember sort of thinking, right, we're getting into the strongest part of the day now with these thermals. I should be able to start pushing on a little bit and start making some ground, because I've got a goal. I want to make 100 kilometres today, really. I felt that not having done it this year, or that time not having done 100 kilometres, I really sort of expected it from myself. And once I'd passed Grantham and was at cloud base, I knew I was in that sort of territory then. I knew that the 100k line was somewhere around there.
You didn't see your distance from takeoff on your GPS? You didn't actually know that you'd done 100
no,
kilometres?
No, I don't have it set. I don't set takeoff and distance from takeoff on my GPS. No, I don't want to know the fine detail like that, really. I've got a rough idea that 100 is around Grantham.
Yeah. I think psychologically that's probably quite a good idea, because I stopped doing it when I was just always sort of going 2k past my previous personal best, because it was like, oh, I've done it now. And then yeah. I sort of stopped concentrating, whereas when I stopped doing that, that's when I flew further, you know, longer distances.
Right. Ah, so it's, yeah, so it works for you as well. Yeah.
It does, yeah.
My theory about having a distance from takeoff on my GPS is I'm going to concentrate often too much on that, and really it's not important. You just do the best you can with the day, and, you know, you stay up and just fly as far as you can, whether it's 50k or whether it's 100k or 150k, you just do your best you can with the day, and that sort of satisfies me. Out of all the cross-country flights I've ever sort of flown in Britain, must be quite a few now, I suppose, I like to try and sort of do the best I can with the day. I've never landed 100% satisfied. So I think that's probably a little bit of a driving force to make me sort of still think about the meteorology, still try and learn a little bit more, still try and improve things and what have you. Going back to the sort of the time when I landed when I was nearly satisfied. It was a flight from Parlick, again in the British National, years and years and years ago. I think, the task was open cross-country, open distance, and I'd made quite a big error right at the start. Two gaggles, I think, had got away with all the top names in, had got away from the hill before me, and I was getting sort of quite wound up on the hill anyway. I climb up and I get away and I start making my way downwind and sort of fly with a few other pilots here and there, and little by little one or two drop by the wayside sort of thing, and then I get right across the Yorkshire Dales and I'm now looking into the Vale of York, and as I look across the Vale of York I can see on the high ground of the North York Moors these lovely cumulus, but the Vale of York is all blue. I've got like next to no chance of getting across there. Apart from that, I'm an hour and a half, 2 hours late anyway in getting away from the hill. And I'm imagining these two lead gaggles that got away earlier. I'm convinced they're under these clouds on the North York Moors. And there's a little bit of a scrag of cloud starts to form out in the Vale of York, and I glide out towards it, and I find a bit of a climb, and I climb, I don't know, 1,500 foot with it, something like that. But it's not good enough. I don't get to base, and I glide off. I know this is like a terminal glide. I'm sure the sea breeze has come in around both sides of the North York Moors and met in the middle, and that's why we've got no cumulus in the Vale of York. And I land, I think, somewhere near Thirsk. And in those days, we didn't have mobile phones. I sort of pack up and get to a telephone and phone back into the competition sort of headquarters, and I find out I've won the day. But until I made that phone call, I was so cheesed off. So that's the nearest anyway I've come to being satisfied with the flight.
But presumably when you've flown to the coast and you can't actually go any further, you must have a sense of satisfaction as well, because you've just run out of land. You know, you've gone as far as it's possible to go on that day, or not?
Well, here's a big confession. I have never landed on the beach.
No.
No? I have never landed on the beach.
Well, that'll be your next target then.
Yeah, lots of people think I have and just presume I have, but no, I've never landed on a beach. Oh, well, there's another angle on this later on in the story of the big day. Where have I got to now in the story of the big day? We're Peterborough, aren't we, somewhere? I've got me 100-odd, yeah. And I know by Peterborough, and it's sort of quite high, I'm getting on to sort of about, that's not far off the 160-odd, which was the last time sort of I left the record. I was a bit further east that time. I can see Cambridge coming up and a couple more climbs, and I'm sort of alongside Cambridge, and I go towards, now I've got a memory of Nigel Pryor telling me that his 189 kilometre record, he landed somewhere near Cambridge. So when I'm at Cambridge and at Cloud Base, I think, well, if he was 190 something there and I'm at Cloud Base, then I'm probably going to get over the 200 here. I can see, I know I'm somewhere near the 200 mark anyway. I glide back east, I remember there, to put me just slightly downwind of Newmarket. And again, it works, and I climb up quite nicely, and so I sort of in my heart, I know that I'm over the 200 now, really. And so I suppose I have a little smile to myself, I'm quite chuffed. I also now, I've got slightly different priorities. There's no reason to sort of really worry about making big distance and pushing on and on and on. I need to make sure that I don't sort of blow it and fly into controlled airspace, because I've never flown this part of the country now. This is beyond the furthest I've ever been before. Now, yeah, I think it was just after Peterborough. Essentially, I've flown off the way I've got my paper air map folded, so I have to take that out of the plastic holder, and I'm trying to sort of refold it, and of course, the wind's a bit awkward, and I'm trying not to lose control of this thing, and at the same time, I'm on the glide because that's the only time really I've got the time to get the map out and try and sort it out. But I stumble into a flipping thermal and I've got the paper map in my hand. And I need to start turning, so I just ram it down the front behind my chest strap, by my stomach there, and sort out the climb and get back up to as high as I can. And then get it out again on the next glide. But I get it out enough and sort it out that I can see the big picture with Stansted sort of down track and to the right, to the west side. And there's a couple, I can't remember their names, but there's a couple of RAF bases to the left of track as well. And I'm studying the air map sort of quite a lot. I'm in and out and zooming in and out on the Garmin and the other sat-nav sort of thing with the colour air maps. Just trying to make sure that I do know how high I can go and breach a bit of airspace here, because Stansted sort of steps out and up and out and up and out and up, and I'm going to, with a bit of luck, sort of be soon under there. I can see it also. I can start to see the south coast approaching now, which was quite a nice feeling, really. And I'm also thinking, I could get, I can get to the sea here. That could be a little first. But anyway. I'm still navigating, and I need to make moves east now to stay away from Stansted, because if I stumble into one huge, great, big mother of all thermals, I could easily end up perhaps just getting sucked up and sucked into controlled airspace, and that's it. That's the waste of a flight. So anyway, I make space to the east and stay away from the lower controlled airspace bit. But I'm thinking to myself, right, I can sort of get to the coast here, maybe, well, possibly. But if I do go all the way to the coast, then there's no records to be broken anymore from Bradwell Edge. And that'd be a bit of a shame in some ways, really, because it's my local site. And I suppose I would go and fly it still, but there wouldn't be that big carrot anymore of being there on the good day and making the effort of being ready the day before and all the other bits of preparation, if there wasn't a record to be had anymore. Perhaps I'm getting a bit greedy, I don't know.
It's a funny concept to think that you would land just so that, you know, the site's still there for you.
Well, yeah. I thought that, but then Steve Hudson, when I got back to Derbyshire the next day or a couple of days later, I met Steve Hudson. He thought I'd got landed on the beach, and I says, no, I didn't. I'd landed about 8 kilometres short. And I say, otherwise, there's nothing to do from Bradwell. And he goes, good man, brilliant, and shakes my hand. So, okay, well, I'm not the only one that thinks like that then. Anyway, going back to the story, the day is getting a bit late now. The thermals aren't quite as strong. I find the climb in I fall in it and I'm out of it and I'm in and out and I'm in and out. My concentration's still sort of in this turmoil of what the hell do I do? Do I try and get to the coast right out on the beach, or do I land a bit short, or what do I do? And anyway, I fall out the thermal again and I just, oh, sod it. I've got the British record again. I know that. I'm just going to glide. And if I stumble into a great big thermal and it sucks me up and I go to the beach, great. And if I land, I'll land. So, anyway, off I glide, and the sink's quite strong. And anyway, I ended up landing about, I think it's about 8 kilometres short of Frinton-on-the-Sea. I deliberately land right next to this little row of houses, next to this little road, hoping that somebody will see me. And it works. There's a little, I think about 6 or 7 people come out of the houses and sort of having a bit of a chat, and somebody makes me a cup of tea, and this other lass, they ask, how do you get back home? You know, you've flown from there. How do you get home? I said, well, I'll catch a train. And, somebody asked, do you need a lift then to the nearest train station? Oh, that'd be brilliant. Of course. So, I finish off packing up, I drink my tea and jump in the car and off I go to the train station.
Amazing. So an amazing flight and a brilliant retrieve.
it went pretty well, really. I got to the train station. It was one with a proper little railway office, and they printed me out a little itinerary and the places I needed to change, that sort of thing. And I think it was about £75 to go the roundabout way to get back to Sheffield, but wasn't the quickest. If I wanted the quickest route, that meant going into the centre of London and then back out, but that was going to be about £130, and I'm a skinflint, so I went the cheap way.
And how long did it take you to get back?
Well, the itinerary said I'd be back in Sheffield, I think, about 10 past 12, which was pretty good, really, because it was probably about 6:30 by that time. But somehow I ended up getting on an early train to Stowmarket, and there was a faster train that then jumped ahead of me. And anyway, I ended up back in Sheffield at 1:15 in the morning.
Do you think it's beatable, the record?
Yeah, of course it is, yeah. Slightly stronger wind, maybe slightly earlier start, slightly longer daylight. I was on the ground at, was it, before 6:00 anyway. And on a good day, people are landing at sort of 6:00, 6:30, I think, on a really good day. So, yeah, of course it'll be broken. Yeah,
okay. Yeah, you landed at 5:20 in the afternoon.
Right.
Some people only set off on a cross country at that point, at that time.
Yeah, yes. Of course it'll go. Yeah, maybe just do another couple of K, and so it's 155K and 156K and whatever. Oh, I remember. When I'm flying along before I've landed, I've got this idea in my head that to break a record, you've got to break it by 1% for it to be valid. And I'm trying to work out, when I don't really know how far Franklin on the sea is. I've never actually worked this out. Exactly. And so I'm trying to guesstimate what 1% would be away from the beach. So if I am going to land short, and anyway, it's just more things fuddling up me concentration in that last thermal. But as it is, it turns out British records, all you've got to do is beat the previous record. It doesn't matter by how much. It can be just a couple of 100 meters, and it's yours. So that 1% rule is only effective for FAI world records. Here's a little interesting bit, I think. Obviously, I flew for quite a long time, 7.25 hours, so there's a bit of stamina thing there. And maybe my stamina with me old age, now I'm 47, might actually be better than it was when I was sort of in my 20s, early 30s. So maybe that's a factor, perhaps, that helped me stay up for so long.
Why do you think your stamina's better now than it was in your 20s?
Well, I believe it's better in sort of older people anyway. Younger people, I think, have sort of maybe better performance, but for a shorter duration. And I think older people, I might be wrong here, of course some sports psychologist will tell me otherwise perhaps, but I thought up to a point anyway, your stamina improves with a bit of age. I also, my work now, I work on an oil rig up in Aberdeen. And I drive it, I just find it the easiest way to do. And that is typically 6-7 hours drive from my house up to Aberdeen, where I catch the helicopters from. And I do it in one push. I can get in the car here, drive to Aberdeen. And when I first started going up there, I did used to find it a bit tiring. And I might have a can of Red Bull or something like that. But for the last 7 or 8 years, I don't need anything at all. I might have a drink and a sandwich, that sort of thing, but I don't need any energy boost to keep my concentration level going. So maybe that has helped. I don't know.
So have you got any advice for anybody who wants to attempt to break your record?
I suppose a bit of preparation. Yeah, you need all your gear sorted out. I'm sure anybody that's capable of breaking the record has probably already been poring over the air maps and has seen the various routes around Britain, sort of from Treatcliffe out. Well, actually, I was going to say Treatcliffe out to the South Wales coast, but I don't think it is. I think you've got to go to the Pembroke Peninsula now to break the record. But anyway, yeah, preparation. Eat and drink in the air. I mean, years ago I discovered eating and drinking in the air, but that made a big difference, having a Camelback and a little chocolate bar or banana or something like that to eat. Got to be pretty comfortable, I suppose, with the gear, in that it's not physically hard for you to fly and requires a lot of concentration to stop collapses and things. And that day, it was a bit rough and a bit bumpy at times. Some of the climbs, I think, made 800 foot a minute and were a bit choppy, but I didn't have any collapses at all. Yeah, you need your gear fairly well sorted.
Did you do it in your Deglo Sky Systems 1980s flying suit?
I did, yes. The pictures that might appear in Skywings of me in, I think it's a little village of Beaumont where I landed, yes, I'm wearing my flying suit. My faithful flying suit, yeah.
Brilliant.
But, Have you been in a sports shop recently and looked at the colours of all the things on the shelf?
Yeah, no, we've gone full circle. You know, 30 years later, we've got the same gear, the same colours.
Yeah, maybe that's why I'm back on the flying scene now.
Thanks, Richard. We'll talk again next time you break your record or you get to the beach, whichever comes first.